The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
The Buddha, in his exploration, he really was looking at the question of how do our minds work such that we get all tied up in knots and struggle and suffer. And so, you know, he had that question and had the question, is it possible to find freedom from that suffering? And his way of going about looking at that question was basically to look at his own mind, to sit down and start looking at what was going on inside of his own mind. And as he did that, it's kind of amazing to me that, you know, what he discovered and what he was able to articulate. He articulated so much about the processes of how the mind works and what kinds of things kind of get us all hooked into our patterns of wanting things to be other than they are or wanting to hold on to things. And he also articulated not only the ways we get hooked, but also how we can free ourselves, how we can train the mind and understand, basically by doing the same thing he did, by beginning to understand what's going on in there, we can begin to unhook from the ways that we are habitually caught, our habitual patterns and habits that keep us stuck in all of the things that we're frustrated by or confused by or annoyed by, all of those reactive emotions, all of the things that we habitually or that we, you know, we do experience as struggle, as suffering. He recognized and understood that those are internal processes, that it's possible to shift the way we relate to experience and relate to the world and move our minds in a completely different direction. And so he articulated both how suffering happens, what's going on there, and how it's possible to use the processes in the mind to shift us in a new way. And kind of in the middle, he described just basic functions of the mind, what the mind does, how it works. And that's kind of a little piece of what I want to point to today is a teaching that he talked about. He talked about five processes of mind, five processes of body and mind, basically. And in particular, he pointed to both how these processes will tend to misunderstood and in our habitual way of meeting the world with these processes will tend to get caught in suffering. But these very same processes are the same ones that will help us to find our way to compassion and love and mindfulness and concentration and wisdom and generosity and joy and freedom. So I wanted to just lay out these five processes a little bit and then focus primarily on one of them. So the term that the Buddha used for these five processes, kind of a technical term, sounds technical in English anyway. It's the five aggregates. And while that sounds like a technical term in English, and is kind of a technical term in English, it's not a typical word that we use in our language. Basically, in the Pali, the word is a much more ordinary word. It basically means... The word is khanda in Pali, and it basically means bundle or heap, something like that. And so, in a way, the Buddha here is talking about five heaps of stuff that make up our experience, just what goes on in there. And he divided it up into these five processes, these five categories of experience, five things that happen and go on. And so, you know, the word, we can use the word aggregate, but it's basically just five groups of things that go on in our system. And in particular, the Buddha said these five kinds of processes at work are useful for us to understand. And so these five processes are basically the processes of our body. And right now I'm just going to name them and then I'll just go through them briefly. So there's the processes of our body, you know, all the stuff that goes on in our body. And then four processes of mind. And it's useful, I think, to recognize that the Buddha pointed to, in terms of the question he was trying to answer about suffering, he recognized that the what's going on in our bodies, you know, we'll experience things that are pleasant or unpleasant. And, you know, it's like, that's just the way our bodies are. And so what he realized is that when we suffer about things that are happening in our bodies and when we suffer about things that are going on in the world, it's not about the actual events so much that are inherently creating suffering. And so when we fall down and bruise our knee or break an arm or something like that, we typically do suffer. We don't like it, we're frustrated, we're angry, we're mad at ourselves for having, you know, done that, or we're mad at somebody else for having gotten in our way and tripped us or whatever, you know. So we do react. We're frustrated, we're angry, we're distressed about the pain. And yet the Buddha recognized that itself is not the physical experience itself. That the physical experience is a kind of an unpleasant experience, and that's going to be there. But that the suffering that's created is happening in our minds. We are reacting to that pain. We don't like it. We want it to go away. We're mad. We're frustrated. We're confused. We're wanting pleasant experience again. And so the Buddha really highlighted essentially the processes of mind as being important in terms of exploring how the mind gets all hooked up in the ways that it suffers. And so in this particular set of heaps of stuff he talked about, four of them have to do with processes of mind. And those four are feeling. That experience is either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, basically. Every experience, our physical experience, our mental experience, every sight, every sound, every taste, every touch has a quality, a feeling tone to it that's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then there is the perceiving aspect of experience, that we recognize things that are going on. We take in experience. Looking out at this room, I see chairs, I see walls, I see people, I see the floor, I see paper. That's all a perceptual process at work, actually, in the mind. What I am experiencing, you know, what the eyes take in, and it's amazing to me that the Buddha figured this out. You know, we know this in our science, in modern day science. We know what goes on in the eye, and it's just little blips of, you know, form and color. It's little tiny part, pixels of form and color, and, you know, just that's all that the eye takes in. And everything that we see objects, that's created in the mind. And so this is the process of perception. This is that part of the functioning of mind. And then there's the knowing aspect, that we know experience. You know, there's a sight and there's our eye, and there's kind of this kind of consciousness that there's a knowing, that we know that we're seeing, we know that we're hearing. Kind of apart from what we are hearing and what we are seeing, which is the perception side, we just know that we know. We know that we're seeing, we know that we're hearing. And so those three processes, the feeling, the perceiving, the knowing, those are kind of the basic processes by which we take in experience. You know, and that our bodies are essential in that, because it's, you know, it's our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue, our skin that kind of interacts with the world. And, you know, that meets the world, the physical contact with the skin and the sound waves with the ear, all of those come in. And then the mind recognizes them, feels them, knows that they're happening. And so that's kind of the given of our experience, those three processes, the knowing, the feeling, and the perceiving. That's what comes in. The fourth mental process is the one I really want to focus on today. It's called volitional formations, another kind of technical sounding term. But basically it's all of those processes of mind that are related to motivation and intention. They are basically the processes in our mind that shape our experience. So those are things like all of our emotions, our thoughts, our beliefs, our views, states of mind even. And so things like anger, confusion, frustration, hatred, irritation, annoyance. All of the reactive emotions fit into this category. And then all of the kind of beautiful emotions too, like joy and generosity and love and compassion, and states of mind like mindfulness and concentration fit in this category. And then, you know, all of the kind of the thoughts that we have, these are also, you know, they have a kind of a intentional or motivational quality. When we look at our thoughts, they often reflect something about what we think or what we want to do or how we want to be or where we want to go. And so our thoughts have this kind of motivational quality to them too, motivating kind of quality to them. And then beliefs are in there. Beliefs are kind of a subtler level of this mental formation than thoughts are. I think beliefs are often not articulated in our minds. They're often not so clear in our minds. You know, they tend to be more below the surface. They tend to be the kinds of things that we've absorbed from our culture, from our families, those views, those opinions, those ideas that we have about how we are, who we are, how we should engage in our lives. There's many levels of beliefs, but many times beliefs are not so clearly articulated. They're just kind of below the surface, and they just kind of, when we're not really aware of them, they're kind of guiding us in a way. Guiding us, shaping us. I like to think of these volitional formations in a way essentially as the shapers of our lives. You know, if we are experiencing an aversive or a kind of a reactive state of mind, that shapes how we feel, you know. It shapes how we meet the world. It shapes what we think. It shapes how we talk to people. If we have anger in our experience, when we, you know, we're driving and, you know, maybe we're frustrated by something that happened, you know, before we left home, and maybe somebody kind of cuts in right in front of us. And because we've got that frustration, you know, the anger may kind of flare there, because it's like we're seeing through this filter of that mind state. And imagine if you'd instead come from a really good experience, you know, kind of a delightful time. You had plenty of time to get where you're going. You're feeling just very easeful and peaceful. And the same thing happens. You might find, oh, that person must be feeling kind of frustrated with all the traffic. Let me just back in and give them some space. And so the very same incident can be experienced very differently based on these mental formations, these shaping qualities in the mind. And so these shaping qualities, this is really the key in a way, in terms of whether we find ourselves meeting the world with reactivity and frustration and feeling suffering, feeling distress, feeling stress, feeling unease. The word suffering is pretty big. I mean, sometimes, if you're just feeling a little bit of discomfort, you might not think, oh, I'm suffering. But the word that's translated as suffering from the Pali has a broad meaning. It means from the subtlest kind of unease, just the subtlest sense of offness, things aren't quite right, don't feel quite right, to the major kinds of suffering. And so the Buddha was interested in understanding all of it. So the shaping forces in our mind are kind of responsible for whether we end up kind of tumbling in along with moving in the direction of unease and stress and confusion, or whether we move in another direction. And so this is really a key for us to understand. How do we shape our minds? Do we want to shape our minds in the direction of ease and peace and freedom? So these mental formations as constructors, as shapers of our experience, the Buddha actually pointed to this in his description or his definition of this particular piece of the puzzle in our experience. He said that basically these mental formations, these shapers, will shape our experience of the body. They will shape our experience of our feeling. They will shape our perceptions. They will shape what we know. And they will shape our emotions and our thoughts and our views. And so this shaping is, it's not just about having those particular emotions, but they actually, those emotions, those views, those beliefs change how we take in experience. So when I talked about those first three of those processes of feeling and perception and knowing as being what comes in, we think that what is coming in is kind of just reality. That's how we think of the world. We're seeing the world as it is. That's what we think. And yet in this teaching, the Buddha points to that these mental formations shape what we take in. It's as if we, with particular emotions, we've got a filter, and that filter will tend to incline us towards feeling things in a certain way, incline us towards perceiving things in a certain way, incline us towards knowing some things and not other things, and incline us towards particular views, opinions, ideas, other emotions. And so, as an example, take anger. Anger, we know, actually, we see this. We can see this in our meditation. Sometimes if you experience the arising of anger, And, you know, so knowing this, one thing I want to say here, too, just before I go into this example, is that, you know, sometimes hearing this, hearing that these, you know, reactive emotions are shaping our experience, we might think that, well, what I'm supposed to do then is stop having those reactive emotions. But the medicine and the kind of the what the Buddha offers us in terms of turning the direction of our minds from all this reactivity to more helpful shapings is understanding and witnessing our experience. This is what he did. He started looking at his mind. And, you know, to not say, okay, that's bad, I should not feel that, repress that feeling, but more look at it. You know, it's like, okay, anger is arising. What is the experience of anger? How is it shaping the body? What is it, how does it make the body feel? And so this exploration of having mindfulness of what's happening, that will begin to give the mind a different, it's actually a completely different relationship to that reactive emotion than our habitual relationship. Now, our habitual relationship to anger is to buy into it, that we, you know, we let it shape our body, we let it shape our feelings, we let it shape our speech, we let it shape our views and our opinions and our ideas. We let it do that because we're carried away by it. And the exploration of holding it in a container of mindfulness is a completely different thing. It allows the mind to begin to understand something about that state, that reactive emotion. It allows the mind to begin to understand something about it. And in that understanding, the mind begins to recognize, oh, this is leading in a direction that hurts this being. You know, this was a big realization for me early on when I was looking at anger in particular in my experience. I had a big anger issue, huge. It was a big part of my life. And at one point, I got so angry at a particular person, it was making me pretty non-functional. And fortunately for me, somebody sent me a book on mindfulness at that point, and I started looking at my anger instead. And that was the gist of what I got from this book. It's like, try being aware that anger is happening instead of just following the anger. And I didn't know how that would work, but I began just looking at that, just seeing, you know, what happens there. And what I saw pretty quickly was, wow, when anger's happening, it doesn't feel good. It hurts a lot. Boy, this is an unpleasant experience. And I was kind of shocked because it's so obvious that it's painful. It's so obvious when you take just a split second to ask the question, what does it feel like to be a human being experiencing this difficult emotion? It's very obvious that it hurts. And yet, in that, seeing that, I could see that the mind had completely, before that, had completely bought into the anger and, you know, believed that somehow that anger was going to do something for me. It was going to make me feel better sometime in the future when sometime I managed to get back at that person who was making me so angry, who I thought was making me angry. I didn't realize my own mind was making me angry at that point. But so the seeing that the mind had deceived itself into thinking somehow that this anger was going to make me feel better, and in the moment of the anger itself, it was definitely not making me feel better. That information is part of what the mind understands with the mindfulness. And it's a completely different relationship than just following the anger to seeing that this is not something that leads to happiness and ease and well-being in this moment. And seeing that, the mind begins to be more interested in a different way, a different orientation. And so we can see as we look at reactive emotions, for example, anger, in our experience with mindfulness, we begin to see how does it shape these other experiences, these other processes. So for me, when I feel anger, you know, it creates a kind of feeling of pressure and heat in the body. It's like the chest is burning. The throat can get tight. The face often gets contorted. And so anger is shaping the body in this way. It tends to shape whether we're experiencing things as pleasant or unpleasant. When we're angry, at least in my experience again, you know, it's like pretty much everything I turn to, it's like my radar is actually orienting to look for things that are unpleasant. It's like I'm angry about this thing, and then there's that thing, and I'm right on those things, those other things that make me angry. So it's like the mind has just got this radar out for the unpleasant. And the experience tends to be unpleasant in the moment when anger is happening. And so anger shapes the feeling. Tends to be unpleasant. The feeling of anger itself is unpleasant. And what we orient to seeing and hearing, we tend to orient towards unpleasant things seen and heard. Or we, in a way, lay over an unpleasant view, almost. It's like the attitude the anger kind of orients us towards interpreting things as unpleasant. So an example of this, I was in kind of an aversive state one time when I was on a retreat and I was doing walking meditation. And I knew I was experiencing aversion and I was noting it and I was exploring it in my body, and yet it was still pretty strong, and there were things not really being seen because when I turned around at the end of one walking path, you know, I'd been just doing walking back and forth on my walking path, you know, and at one point I turned around. It was my walking path. It was really my walking path while I was averse. And I turned around and somebody else had put their shoes at the end of my walking path. And boy, did my mind take that aversively. And, you know, again, it's kind of like that person cutting in. If I'd been in a state of, like, ease and peace and you know, like, calm, when I turned around and saw somebody else's shoes, it might be like, wow, look at all that color, those orange shoes. Wow, look at that. But I was in an aversive state. And so what the mind did is exploded in aversion. Who put those shoes down there? Basically, seeing those shoes as an unpleasant thing. So the aversion tends to shape how we see things. See things as unpleasant tends to make us see things as unpleasant. And then we also perceive things through a lens of anger or aversion when that's happening. So we see somebody else doing something, for instance, and we interpret it in a certain way, you know. Here's an example, you know, maybe we're having a conversation with somebody and we're experiencing frustration in the conversation and we see an expression cross their face. And we interpret that, the way we perceive that expression is, you know, in some way informed or influenced by the anger. Often it can be, unless we're really aware of the anger and really attuned to that we may be perceiving through this filter of anger, we are likely to interpret and perceive that facial expression as being maybe a threat or an expression of dissatisfaction or dislike. So we perceive things through that filter also. And, you know, maybe the person just had a little bit of gas in their stomach and it created an expression on their face. You know, we don't really know what happened there. But we tend to interpret and perceive things through the filters that we're seeing. And then not only that, you know, this is kind of amazing, but there are times when, you know, we think we're really just taking everything in. We assume our eyes are like cameras, our ears are like microphones, our eyes are picking up everything out there, our ears are picking up what's out there, and that we're just like these cameras and microphones receiving everything that's happening. But our minds don't really work that way. They're more selective than that. And our mind states have us picking certain things out of the environment to pay attention to, and not other things. And so what we know, what's available to be known, will be shaped by those mind states. Let's see, example of that. I have one, I use this one a lot, so I'm trying to find another one, but it's not coming, so I'll use the one that I use a lot. This one is an example around an agenda. So not even a reactive mind state. Even just an agenda in our minds can have us see certain things and not other things. And so I was watching a program on television that was about perception, actually. And they were pointing out, using a lot of magician tricks to kind of point out the ways that magicians use perception and use this kind of selective attention that we have to deceive us into fooling us that they're doing magic. And at one point they said, okay, so watch this magic trick. See if you can see what's going to happen. They told us in advance, you know, they're going to put some keys in a cup and then somehow the keys are going to disappear from the cup. And so, you know, you kind of knew in advance maybe where to be looking. So I was really focused on seeing, can I figure out how that magic trick worked? And I might have figured it out, I don't know, because they didn't actually tell us later, because the point of this particular exercise was something else. And it was, after they showed that video, they said, and by the way, did you see the giant bunny walk across the screen? And no, I had not seen the bunny. I had been very focused. The agenda of looking at that had screened out anything else. So the kind of focus, it's called selective attention. The mind kind of zeroes in on certain things. And while it's doing that, it is not seeing other things. And so agendas can do this, but also emotions. And, you know, this particular piece of the way mental formations work, I think, is really humbling, you know, because there's a famous quote by Anais Nin that I think speaks to this this truth. She said, "We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are." And that is so true, that our views, our opinions, our ideas, our beliefs, our emotions shape what we take in. And this is a big field right now. I mean, in our culture, it really does seem right now, in our country in particular, you know, people are really dividing. You know, they're dividing into very different perspectives. And what seems to be happening is that people take in information that corresponds to their particular view. you gravitate towards what agrees with what you already think. And either you discount or you don't even take in information that does not confirm your pre-existing views. And so this is an important piece of information for us. In our culture, too, right now, it's probably pretty useful for us to maybe go searching out information that we don't necessarily agree with so that we can begin to recognize our proclivity for preferring to take in information that already confirms what we believe. So not only do our reactive emotions shape us, our beautiful emotions shape us too. And so when love is arising, that shapes how we feel. That shapes how we take in information. That shapes what we take in. It shapes what we perceive. So the one thing that the Buddha pointed to basically, kind of a fundamental teaching that he offered, was that greed, aversion, and delusion are the shapers of suffering, the shapers of unease, of distress, of dissatisfaction. And so those are the kind of basic core three mind states that kind of end up mutating into the whole range of reactive emotions that we have. And so greed, aversion, and delusion shape suffering. And the Noble Eightfold Path, wisdom, and skillful intention, and wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration, that shapes peace, freedom. And so we can be curious. And one of the best things is that the Noble Eightfold Path, you know, wise mindfulness, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. We can use those while we are experiencing our reactive emotions. It's not like we have to somehow get rid of the reactive emotions in order to be on the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path, it's like the shapings of wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration are more powerful than the shapings of greed, aversion, and delusion. Ultimately, they are more powerful because they can hold greed, aversion, and delusion. And so the mindfulness, the wisdom, the energy, the concentration can hold the reactive experience and not have it kind of reinforcing the grooves. And so essentially what I'd say is when something like anger or irritation or frustration is held by mindfulness and wisdom, then what's shaping the mind is the mindfulness and wisdom, not the reactive emotion. It's as if the mindfulness and concentration and effort put those reactive emotions into neutral. So they're not driving the bus anymore. And instead, mindfulness and concentration and energy and wisdom are kind of guiding the direction of the mind, shaping the current of the mind towards basically understanding those patterns so that the wisdom and the understanding that comes as we see how those reactive patterns work. It's like, you know, so one example for myself, when looking at that anger I looked at early on in my practice, I watched it over the course of quite a few months and really got it that anger hurt. And then one day, while I was, you know, doing something very simple, ordinary in my kitchen, I noticed a thought in my mind that was kind of heading in the direction of anger. There was enough mindfulness that I saw this thought come up about the person that I was angry with. And yet, in that moment, I saw I wasn't angry right then and there, but I did see this kind of, almost this welling up of intention towards jump on that thought and think more thoughts in order to get angry at that person. So there's this kind of habitual movement when that person arose in my mind, when a thought of that person arose in my mind, there was a strong habit of kind of, yeah, that person, and they did that, and they deserve to be miserable, and, you know, and it would, my mind would just jump on that train. But seeing it in that moment, seeing that direction, having spent months recognizing that when the mind is caught by anger, it's suffering here, this being is suffering, that the mind seeing the mind kind of heading in that direction, it was like I was reaching out for touching a hot stove, and the mind just said, you don't have to do that. And the mind let go of that movement towards anger. I didn't have to do that. It was like the mind understood the wisdom. It's really the wisdom of having seen anger hurts here, now. The wisdom of having seen that. The mind recognized, the wisdom recognized, you jump on that train, it's going to hurt. Just like reaching out, you know, we know, you get close to that heat, your body knows, no, don't do that, and your body withdraws. So the having spent the time to be mindful of that pattern of anger over and over again, the wisdom allowed the mind to not go there. That was the experience, that the mind did not go to anger in that moment. And that was a very, very powerful moment of basically understanding. It's kind of like I had been doing this practice and seeing, you know, yeah, I guess it's kind of helping. You know, I'm not kind of caught as much in the anger. But in that moment, I think the mind really understood. I understood how this works. This practice works to some extent by giving the mind an education about its habits and patterns. Typically, when we're caught by our reactive emotions, you know, the reactive emotions are kind of, you know, we're buying into their beliefs. You know, the belief in anger is, at least my belief in anger in that particular situation is, yeah, this anger is going to make that person really miserable. That was my belief. And what the mindfulness began to reveal was, well, it was pretty obvious actually in this case, because the person I was angry with was nowhere in sight, because I was on a little island in the middle of the South Pacific and he was in California and he didn't even know I was angry. So he wasn't experiencing any suffering from my anger. But that belief was exposed, and in seeing that belief and then recognizing, oh, but it hurts here, that was a big lesson. It's kind of an obvious one in some ways, but it kind of stunned me that I hadn't really known that before until I started exploring being mindful of those difficult emotions. And so the practice of mindfulness gives the mind an education about what's really happening with those emotions, how they're shaping our experience, what the consequences are. And the mind begins to, the wisdom that's growing there begins to basically help the mind move in a different direction. Like my experience of the mind just saying, yeah, you don't need to go there. You can let that go. And I'm not saying that the mind did not get angry again. It definitely did. There were times when the mind was not quite as present for seeing something arise. And yet there was such an understanding that happened there that I really got the value of the Eightfold Path. I understood the value of the shaping in that direction. All of those qualities, those beautiful qualities of wise view and wise intention and cultivating the effort and the mindfulness and the concentration to meet those difficult states. And so, you know, we don't have to think in terms of the shapings, you know, the shaping of experience. It's wonderful in so many ways, actually, that our minds are put together the way they are. When we bring mindfulness to our experience, there's a kind of, it's almost like a gravitational pull in the direction of more well-being. Because our systems are designed to move towards well-being. Our systems want to move towards ease and peace and happiness. And yet, partly the way our human being is put together, we have a lot of options, and basically the ways that we typically, habitually engage in moving towards well-being are based on some basic fundamental misunderstandings about where well-being actually lies. And our system is, in the absence of different information, in the absence of hearing something like, actually there's a different kind of ease and peace and happiness that's possible. You know, our usual way of thinking about what happiness is getting the next thing that I want and getting rid of the next thing that I don't want. And, you know, we basically think that's happiness. Certainly our culture tells us that. You know, all the advertisements tell us that. Everything that we've learned, get the job, get the relationship, get the toys, you'll be happy. Have the vacation, you'll be happy. You know, get the right job, you know, that, and it's all about the getting of something. And the you know, find ways to avoid the unpleasant. You know, so that is basically, that's, we think that's as good as it gets. And then the Buddha comes along and he asks the questions, is that as good as it gets? Because there's a lot of suffering all bound up in that. Even as we're doing that, there's the fear of losing what we have, and there's the confusion about, well, did I do that right and get that thing right? And then there's the aversion when we don't get what we want. And so that process of trying to find happiness in that way, there's a lot of suffering in that. And so he wanted to know, what about, you know, is there something better? Is there a different way? And so he found that it's basically a lot of confusion in our minds, that the belief, essentially kind of that mental formation of a belief that getting what I want, getting rid of what I don't want, that's where happiness will lie. That belief is fundamentally, well, it's, you know, it's fundamentally will keep you stuck at a certain level of happiness. A certain kind of happiness is available through getting what we want and getting rid of what we don't want. The Buddha doesn't deny that that's a kind of happiness. But he said, boy, it's not the best kind of happiness that's out there. There's way better, way more ease and peace that's available than going that route. And his understanding of, you know, what came to him as he began observing how that process works of getting what I want, getting what I don't want, that he found that the suffering there is in the very movement to want to have and want to get rid of. And that a kind of a letting go of that, there's a deeper, much deeper kind of peace. And so when we begin to get the information, and essentially, you know, when we're caught by the reactive emotions, when we're caught by aversion, when we're caught by frustration or greed or confusion, we are buying into their beliefs. You know, with aversion, we're buying into the belief that getting rid of that thing, that's what's going to do it for me. We're buying into that belief. And the witnessing or being curious about, well, what is this experience? We're buying into that belief that getting rid of that thing is going to make me feel better, and we're not noticing right now that it feels horrible. We're not noticing that because we're kind of in the fantasy or in the idea of the next moments or maybe, you know, the next days. We're thinking it'll be better when I get there. And it's like we're willing to give up the ease and peace here and now for some possibility for happiness in the future when we get rid of that thing, when we get that thing. And so we are foregoing ease and peace in the moment for the possibility of it later. And so as we observe with mindfulness these patterns and habits, we see, the mind begins to see the trade-off that it's making. And it begins to recognize, because there's this movement towards well-being. And this was my experience with that anger. It's like the mind moved me more towards well-being, of letting go of that intention towards anger. Because it understood that there was a different kind of ease and peace that was possible through the letting go of that habit of anger. And so I think that our system inherently wants to move towards well-being. And what I think about the practice as being is giving ourselves a different education than our culture has given us. We're getting an education about what's actually happening. What are we actually experiencing in the moment? In our usual way of going through the world, we are not really here for what's actually going on. And as the mind begins to touch into those shaping qualities of love, of compassion, of mindfulness, of ease, of peace, of generosity, our system really understands, yes, that way lies a different kind of happiness, a deeper kind of happiness. I'm willing to let go of that other kind of happiness for a deeper kind of happiness. And it's time to stop. So, thank you for your attention.